Hi, everybody. Welcome. Yeah, you can clap. Clap for yourself. My name is Mitchell Miller. I am the Student Life Coordinator in Campus Life and Engagement, the organizer of today's Emerging Leaders mini-conference. And I want to welcome you all to Campus Life and Engagement's Emerging Leaders mini-conference, and also congratulate you on coming out today and taking the time to develop your leadership capacity and your interest to get more involved. I know it's a busy time of year, and I know that you have your schoolwork to do, but I really want to thank you all for coming out today. And I think this will be an important event and milestone in your journey throughout university. As I said, it really is important to get involved. I'm a McGill graduate. I was heavily involved when I was a student here. It was definitely one of the best things I can do. The skills, the memories, the friendships, those have lasted long beyond whatever it was I learned in the classroom. I don't know, what did I take? No. Thank you. And so we've done this conference in a lot of different formats over the year. The students who come and attend say wonderful things about it, and really I think the impact is far-reaching. Maybe you'll feel it this semester, maybe you'll feel it in a few years, maybe only when you graduate, but I really think that the lessons and the stories that you get today will be very valuable. And so again, I want to thank you for coming. I also want to thank University Advancement and the McGill Alumni Association for their support of today's event. So when you become a graduate and an alumnus, remember the McGill Alumni Association. Remember how they supported your leadership when you were a student here. Today we're going to start with our keynote. You can see in your program what follows, the workshops, and then a second workshop for next steps. So just some logistical information. That's how the schedule will work, and I'll remind you again after the keynote, but just so you know, we'll be exiting through that door, not the door you came in, but that door. In any case, let's get on with our keynote. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Wanda Bedard. She is a McGill graduate and holds an MBA from HEC Montréal. She is an entrepreneur, a businesswoman, and activist. In the early 2000s, she was shocked into action by the plight of Afghan girls under Taliban rule. In 2006, after researching and volunteering with other organizations, she founded 60 Million Girls, a completely volunteer-based organization that promotes access to a quality education for some of the most vulnerable and marginalized girls in the developing world. You can all follow along with me on page 3. She has been recognized with a number of prizes and awards, including the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal, presented at Rideau Hall in 2012, the Laurie Normand Star Humanitarian of the Year Award, and the Villain International Service Award. I'm really delighted to have Wanda with us here today and look forward to what she has to say. And I welcome you all in helping me welcome Wanda.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. I appreciate it. And I'd just like to echo Mitchell's words and thank you very much for coming out here. I know your schedules are really busy. You got a lot of things to think of, but taking the time to consider leadership, community action is really, really important. And I believe what Mitchell said, that it's really going to have a great impact on your life and be very, very positive. What I hope to do today is just basically share with you a little bit my story of how we started 60 Million Girls, some of the things that we went through, in the hopes that perhaps it will help you if you ever you have a particular issue that you want to support, hopefully give you some ideas, hints, tools to help you along your way. So again, thank you very much. I'd like to start really at the very, very beginning. I was extremely, extremely lucky in life to be born here in Montreal. It's something that's sometimes referred to as the ovarian lottery. You really have no choice where you're going to be born. You have no choice who your parents are or what circumstances you're going to be in. And I just got really, really lucky and won that lottery. So I was born here in Montreal into a great family with parents who really supported me. I had the chance to go to school. I'm a McGill graduate. I remember coming into this room to listen to classes, so it's nice to be here to talk. And went on, did my MBA, founded a manufacturing business in 1991, which I still have today. And I just feel really, really strongly that I've had a lot of luck. As I say, there's no merit in where you happen to be born in life. Around 1998 or 1999, for I'm not sure what reason, I just happened to keep stumbling on articles about the situation of women in Afghanistan under Taliban rule. And I remember the first time I read the article, and I remember reading it, and they were talking about the fact that Afghan women were not allowed to go outside unless they were accompanied by a male family member, and also that girls were not allowed to go to school, women, of course, couldn't vote, and for all intents and purposes, they really couldn't participate in the community at large. And the first time I read that article, I remember thinking, well, that's not possible in this day and age. We're on the cusp of the new millennium. It's not possible that women are not recognized for what they can contribute to society. And so I kind of brushed aside that article and went on with life. And then I saw another article a few weeks later, and this continued for several months. And then I was getting more and more upset as I was reading these articles because I thought, this really doesn't make any sense, and I just don't understand it. And this was before September 11th, so Afghanistan and the Taliban were not quite on the map as they were afterwards. So I think this is going in a loop rather than just stopping. I'm not sure how to fix it to get it out of the loop. In any case, so these articles kept coming along, and I was just getting more and more enraged because I know of the capacity of what women can do. And if I look around the classroom here, there's so many of you. Obviously, you're in university. You've been learning a lot. You can contribute a lot to society, much like men. And one day I was at home, and I was reading yet another article. It was in the paper. It was a Sunday morning, sitting at the kitchen table. And the article was describing a Afghan father who had just sold off his 9-year-old daughter in marriage to a warlord who was 20 years older than her for $750. And I remember almost feeling sick as I was reading this. And I thought, how can a father do this? How can you possibly sell off your daughter for $750? And a 9-year-old girl, you know that she really has nothing to bring to this new partnership with her husband. She's too young. So she'll basically be used as domestic labor and eventually have to have children. And I was so upset. And I think it was the fact, too, that there was actually a price tag attached to her life, to the value of her life, that made me really upset. And I guess I hadn't realized, but over the weeks and months previously, I must have been talking out loud an awful lot, and my two daughters happened to be at the kitchen table with me that day. And my oldest daughter turned around to me, and she said, "Mom, what are you going to do about it?" And I was kind of stunned. And then I thought, you know, she's absolutely right. I can be really upset about an issue. I could be really, really mad. But if I don't participate and I don't try to do something, the situation simply won't change. So that was a real turning point for me. And then, of course, the next second after is, well, what am I going to do? I'm not a specialist in development issues. I don't know why this is happening. I can't just write a check and send it to Afghan fathers in the hopes that they won't be selling their daughters. And so then I spent about a year and a half just trying to understand the issue. And I did what everybody does when you have a question. You either start talking to your friends, so I start talking to my business colleagues and so on. And there's always someone who knows someone who knows someone who did some humanitarian work at some point. So I would start connecting with people who had been working in the field that way. And then, of course, I surfed the internet. And I just was trying to understand. I was really hoping for somebody somewhere to tell me, okay, Wanda, if you do this, it's going to help solve the problem. And of course, life isn't quite like that. So I started also attending conferences and so on. And I did that for about a year and a half, just trying to understand the issues. And as I did that, it became very clear to me very quickly that education is one of the tools that can dramatically change a community and change life for a young girl. I just want to show you a picture which you might have seen going by before. Is it changing it? I'm still having technical difficulties. Sorry, Mitchell. Yeah. Or maybe just from Okay, I'll just keep talking anyways. I'll show you a picture shortly because it was many years later that I actually found a picture that really captured for me what the essence was in that particular article. As I did the research and came out to the conclusion, if you like, that education is really what changes a situation for girls, it was really based on a lot of research and a lot of facts that I saw out there. It's established that for every additional year of schooling that a young girl gets, so this is primary schooling, the maternal mortality rates decrease by 10 to 15% and the infant mortality rates decrease by the same amount. That's for one additional year of schooling. It has a huge, huge impact. If a young girl has the chance to get on to high school, for every additional year of high school, her potential income earnings increase between 15 and 25%. That's one more year of high school. And as a country as a whole, if you can increase by 10% the number of girls in your country going to school, your GDP increases by 3%. If you look at the potential GDP increases in Canada this year, they're at about 2.5% or not even quite that much. So a 3% increase just because you're sending girls to school has a huge impact on the whole country. So armed with those statistics, I said, okay, well, that's great. What I know I want to do in life is to support girls' education. But how do I do that? Again, I'm not an educator. I'm not a specialist in academics. And I thought, well, I have some skills. I have a business. I have marketing skills and so on. Perhaps if I volunteer for an organization, I can use those skills and help move these projects ahead. So I knocked on a lot of doors, did a lot of cold calling. And then ultimately, I ended up at UNICEF. So UNICEF had offices here in Montreal, so I signed on as a volunteer, thinking again I would use my marketing skills or business skills. And of course, one of the first things they said is, well, Wanda, if you want these amazing projects to go forward, of course, you need to have money. You need to fundraise. And I remember thinking the first time, are you kidding? I said, there's no way I want to start bugging my friends for money. So you have to find me something else to do because it's not going to be fundraising. And they go, okay. And so we kept talking over many months, and eventually they did wear me down, and I started doing some fundraising for UNICEF. I started off pretty small, doing some local community events, raised $5,000, raised $15,000, and I thought, this is really getting me nowhere. If I really want to have an impact, we have to be able to raise much more money than that. In the meantime, I was learning tremendously at UNICEF. I was being able to do some public speaking. I worked on emergency campaigns. I was just constantly learning and understanding the issues a little bit better. And finally, this was around 2004, I was asked to do a major fundraiser for UNICEF. Didn't have an awful lot of experience, but what I finally did is I got together a team and we decided to do a big gala event. And I was told that the target had to be $100,000 to raise for that particular event, and I had about 6 months to do it. And, of course, being totally naive and not really knowing much about fundraising, how to do it, I said, oh, sure, must be able to do that. I was able to raise $5,000, was able to raise $15,000, $100,000. How much of a stretch can that be? Well, it was a lot of hard work, I can tell you that. But we did manage to do it. And one of the reasons I was really motivated is that UNICEF was able to find a project that was exactly what I wanted to support. And it was the construction of a school in Burkina Faso in West Africa. It was an elementary school, and it had very many components to it. It wasn't only school construction. It was a water point. It was latrines. It was a daycare center, because there's so many obstacles for girls being able to go forward and get to school. So it was a lot of hard work, but we did manage to raise $100,000. The very next day after the event, I had been invited to go on a study tour with UNICEF in Mozambique, in Africa. And, okay, that is the picture. So we'll run through this. These are some of the statistics that I mentioned. And I'll just explain how we get to 60 million girls. So I did this work at UNICEF, went to Mozambique, learned a lot, spent 2 weeks in the field with some of UNICEF specialists in education, health, water and sanitation, and so on. And I came back, and I was super pumped. And I said, okay, we're going to do another fundraiser. We're going to raise more money. We're going to do this again. Except a big roadblock came up. At about that time, UNICEF was going through major restructuring, and they were centralizing everything in their Toronto offices. So they basically told me they didn't need volunteers anymore. And I thought, that's crazy. Just raised $100,000 for you, all with volunteers. It didn't cost you anything. You have to let us do this again. And anyways, we talked back and forth for about 6 months. It takes me a while sometimes to get the message. And then I realized, I said, I'm beating my head against a brick wall trying to help an organization that can't use me at this time. And that was the genesis for starting our own foundation called 60 Million Girls. So in 2006, we incorporated as a public foundation. It took us a year to get a registration charity to be able to issue tax receipts. And the reason why we chose the name 60 Million Girls is because the statistic at the time was that there was 110 million children of primary school age around the world who were supposed to be in school but who were not, and of those, two-thirds, or 60 million, were girls. So we started out, we were 9 women, and we started out very, very humbly. We had obviously no funds. We had no name like UNICEF to start going and getting funds. But what we decided to do was to do it very low-key, and we just started with our own contacts and networks, and we really just spread the word, and we grew from there. And I'll give you a few statistics of what we were able to do. So since 2006, we've actually raised $2.1 million. We've invested it in 19 projects in 14 countries, directly supporting 15,000 children. And we're completely volunteer-run, and we have administration costs of less than 1%. Because of my business background, I'm known as being extremely, extremely cheap. I won't let us buy anything. I figure there's so many generous people out there and generous organizations and companies that we shouldn't have to use donation money for anything except directly going to the projects in the field. So we've been able to do that. And I'll just show you a few pictures of some of the projects that we've done over the years. This particular one is a school project that we did in Rajasthan, India. So it was school construction, but much more to it than that. Water point is really important because children are often not going to school simply because they have to go get water every day, and it's sometimes an hour walk there and back. So having a water point at the school doesn't stop the family from having water, because the child goes to school at the end of the day, brings it back, and allows them to go to school at the same time. A school garden, often in this particular case it was growing Ayurvedic plants, which was helping for medicinal purposes to have the mothers be able to help their children. And hand washing stations, very important for sanitation. There was also community rooms and a daycare center, because a girl often doesn't go to school simply because she has to look after younger brothers and sisters. If there's a daycare at the school, she can bring them to school, attend herself, and then come back. And again, you're not penalizing the family by having the girl go to school. We've done projects in Central America as well, in Honduras. This particular project was supporting primary school children with books and help in curriculum and so on. But also, at the same time, we built dormitories, because the girls who were able to go through elementary school often were stopped, because to go to high school meant going to another village and leaving home. And the parents were very concerned about their safety. So by building these dormitories that were overseen by some of the local women, the girls were able to go on to high school. We've done 2 projects in Afghanistan, which was really the start of everything that I was doing, and we were really happy to do it. It took us a long time, though, to find a really good partner, because obviously it's an extremely volatile area. We spent one project, we did a lot of work in terms of teacher training, because under the Taliban and even afterwards, girls can't go to school unless they're taught by female teachers. And under the Taliban for many years, girls weren't allowed to go to school. So it was a really difficult situation. So there's a lot of catching up to do to make sure that there's qualified teachers there. I just want to show you this quick graph. This is from UNESCO, to give you an idea of the vast challenge there is in terms of education. And these are statistics based on sub-Saharan Africa, which has the greatest gap in children not going to school. At the very top, you look and you see it's all about primary education. The richest boys and the richest girls, the date at the end is when it's expected that close to 100% of kids in that category will actually be able to complete primary school. And if you look back to the poorest boys and girls, for girls, just to be able to finish primary school, we're talking about another 60 or 70 years. If you look at lower secondary for girls, you're talking of almost 100 years if we don't do anything and change things. So we've done quite a few projects in sub-Saharan Africa, some really innovative things. Again, trying to close the gap between girls and boys going to school, but also, as importantly, or perhaps even more importantly, to ensure that there's good quality education going on. It's estimated by UNESCO that today there's up to 30 million qualified teachers missing around the world. There's that many more that are needed just to be able to bring the level of education of the kids up to the quality that it should be. So this particular picture is from a project that we did in Sierra Leone. It was called Peer Literacy Facilitators. So these were high school girls to whom we gave bursaries, because there's fees for high school, to enable them to go on. But in return, they would go back into the community and they would teach phonetics to kids in elementary school. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of every week, at the end of their high school day, they would spend an hour with a group of 8 to 10 kids teaching phonetics. And they did this from September till June. So they were given a course for about a month. And it had a huge, huge impact, not only helping the kids in terms of being able to read better, but also they act as role models for the young girls at the elementary school level to motivate them and to inspire them, really, to be able to know that they can continue on into high school. This is, again, some of the peer literacy facilitators. We did a project in Uganda with AIDS orphans called the Nyaka AIDS Orphans Project. There, again, it was to support primary school. So these children have basically lost both their parents. Often they're living with their grandmother, but under very, very difficult conditions. So the project is really pretty amazing. It's very community-based and very holistic. Not just getting the kids into school, but ensuring they have something to eat, ensuring that the grandmothers have a place that's safe for the whole family to stay. There's a full-time nurse on staff for any of the kids who are HIV positive to be able to get their medication. There's a food program as well, so it's really very, very well structured, and the kids are well served there. In fact, this year, one of the two projects that we're supporting is the construction of a high school, because again, these children have been doing so well and have been getting to graduate from primary school, but they had no high school to go, and again, it was a particular problem for the girls. Again, a picture from Nyaka with some of the gardens. We did a project in Ethiopia that was based on sports and play to teach leadership skills and self-confidence to the girls there. And the other nice thing about this project is it had girls and boys working together, playing together, but also learning the competencies of each other. It's again in Ethiopia. We did a project in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's an extremely, extremely difficult place for women and for girls. Because of the conflicts, the sexual violence that's going on there, often girls have to leave school for many years, and there's many girls who are in their teens who haven't even completed primary school. So we supported a lot of advanced learning programs, so really trying to cram in 2 or 3 years of primary schooling in about a 1 or 1.5 year period to enable these girls to get going and get to the school level that they should be at. One last thing that I want to finish up with is something that's extremely near and dear to my heart. We've been working in Sierra Leone for the past year and a half on a project. I was there about 2 years ago and went and visited the schools, the elementary schools and the high schools, and we're very pleased because it was even numbers of girls and boys in those schools. But as we spent more time talking with the kids, and even kids in grade 5 and grade 6, in Sierra Leone, even though English isn't the mother tongue, the kids learn English in school. It's the national language. But when we were talking to the kids and we were asking them to write small things in grade 5 and grade 6, we realized that their literacy skills were really, really poor. They had a lot of difficulty. Again, it was a lot a question of not having qualified teachers there. But one thing that kids have, and the adults have, all over Africa, the times that I've visited, even 7 or 8 years ago, are cell phones. There's no access to the internet, there's no electricity, But you see cell phones and little charging kiosks all over the place. And I remember the first time I saw that in Mozambique, we were in the most isolated area in the world, and there was a Vodafone kiosk just popping up. And I thought, that doesn't make any sense. These people have no money. They're so poor. Why are they spending their money on this luxury? But until you realize that it's not a luxury at all, but it's actually a life-saving tool, all of a sudden these people have access to information and they can communicate, and it helps their lives tremendously. So it's really something that's very interesting phenomenon, and you see it all over. And our partner happened to have a small computer lab. They had some very old computers, and somebody had put Microsoft Office Suite on it. So the girls, the peer literacy girls in particular, were following courses, and they were learning Word and PowerPoint and Excel. And we were looking at them and going, well, that's really nice, except you have no printers, you have no papers. That's not something you use in your classrooms. Yes, it's good to know, but couldn't a computer be used for something more than that? So when we came, when I came back, we have a group in our in the foundation, which we call research and development, and we had been looking for about a year and a half or 2 years, really just scouring the world and trying to see what is the most innovative, the most recent thing that's being done in education to try to push forward quality education at a much faster pace than is being done presently. And one of the things that we had seen, and many of you may be familiar with, is a program called Khan Academy. So if any of you know about it, it's a math tutorial software or program, and it's available on the internet free. It's open source. And it basically consists of about 1,000 or more short videos on very specific math topics, going from grade 1 up to university level math. And it's really easy to use, and you look at the video, it's about 15 minutes, you can stop it, you can rewind it, go back, and so forth. And so you can really help yourself with it. And then there's a series of exercises that are attached to it, again, that a person can use. And so we thought, well, why don't we try something like having Khan Academy in Sierra Leone and letting the kids use that as self-directed computer-based learning. So on a tutorial basis, after school on their own, they would have the capacity to try these tutorials and to learn math and improve their skills despite not having a qualified teacher in the class. So we sent over USB keys on which we had downloaded Khan Academy, because there is a light version, a non-internet version. We sent it over, and we didn't really know if it would work on these very old computers, and we didn't know what the reaction would be of the kids. And so we sent it over, and we said, we'll just try it out. And the students tried it out, and they absolutely loved it. It was a totally different way of learning math, and it was something that they could tailor to exactly where they were and where they were having difficulties. So it was really, really great, but we also found we had some technical difficulties with the USB keys and so on. And so we found something a little bit later, which is this little device here, and it's called a Raspberry Pi Rachel. So some of you may be familiar with a Raspberry Pi. It's basically a computer, a motherboard, but doesn't have a screen. But this acts as a server, and there's two things on it. There's a Wi-Fi key, and there's a chip here, much like a chip you would find in your camera. This one is 64 gigs. And on this chip, there's an organization in the U.S. called World Possible who has downloaded not only Khan Academy math, but the science, the economics, the history, the whole suite of subjects. As well, there's about 20,000 e-books on here. There's health encyclopedias, agricultural encyclopedias. You can really download any kind of information. And what's really nice about this is the Raspberry Pi itself costs $80, and all the content is open source, so there's no cost at all. So we sent some Raspberry Pis over, and we've been doing some pilot projects with kids in grade 5 and grade 8 and grade 12 to see how they would use it and how they enjoy it. And the results have been really phenomenal. And, of course, we were doing all this pilot project work in Sierra Leone, and Sierra Leone was hit with the Ebola virus. So we had done the last part of our pilot project from last April till June, and we actually had a hard time getting the data results back simply because all the borders were being closed and so on. But what we decided to do, because of the Ebola crisis, schools were closed as of September, And there's a law in Sierra Leone that not more than 10 people can get together at any one time, again, to try to stop the spread of the disease. So the kids can't go to school, and it's not foreseen that they'll be able to do that for a long time. So with our partner, we thought, well, maybe this is a great opportunity to get as much information to the kids as possible by using the Raspberry Pi. So they've opened up their learning center and allowing kids to come in groups of 10 to have access to the math tutorials and the science and the e-books and so on, at least to be able to get some information out to the kids as we go. So it's been some really exciting times. There's a lot that we see that we can do. From our very humble beginnings to have been able to invest over $2 million in education projects has been really fun. This particular project is having a huge impact. We've shown it to some of our other partners, and now it's going to be used also in Uganda and in Kenya as well. And we really hope to move that forward even more. These are some of the girls, the peer literacy girls, and you can see the cell phones that are there. This also can be used in conjunction with a cell phone or a tablet or anything. And I did have one last slide, but in any case, I'll just tell you about it. We have an event happening next week at Google, at the offices here in Montreal, where we'll be demonstrating in more detail the Raspberry Pi technology, and Google will also be demonstrating Google glasses. So there's going to be 6 pair of glasses there if people are interested. So it's a Sankaset, it's a cocktail event, so it's February 3rd next week from 5 to 7. We do have a few tickets available. They're $50. They have a $35 tax receipt. But it's a great opportunity to see Google offices, to see their technology, and to really see what education and technology can do to change things for the developing world. I know there's virtually no time left for questions. Okay. If there's any questions, please feel free to ask them. And again, thank you very much for having come here. If you need more information, of course, we have a website. So it's www.60milliongirls.org. And I have some small little bookmarks there with a little bit of information. And you can always contact us through the website as well. So thank you very much. People sometimes ask us how we raise money, because if you have any particular issues that you're trying to change, you know at some point that you'll need some money to be able to move things forward. We actually have no events. We do all our fundraising basically word of mouth. We have no government support, and we have no corporate donors. It's all strictly individuals. We raise between $200,000 and $300,000 a year. So depending on how much money we raise, we normally give out grants at $100,000 each. And it's worked really well for us. Again, we don't spend any money on advertising or anything like that, so it's an extremely grassroots organization. I think a lot of people, what they like about the foundation is, first of all, we take extreme care in choosing our projects. We go through a lot of trouble to find good partners in the field. We actually go out to tender every year, have between 10 and 15 projects proposed to us. We go through it and analyze it. We have a list of criteria. And we basically do the due diligence that every donor should do when you're investing in any kind of issue, but you often either don't have the time or you don't have all the information to be able to make a really clear decision. And so I think we've had a lot of success in that way, in that people feel that we're doing all the work. We get reporting back from all the projects that we support for every 6 months until the project's completed. And we have ongoing relationships with our different partners out there. So when you're doing any kind of fundraising, or if you're setting up an organization, an association, it's really, really important that you have as much information about the issues as possible, really educate yourself about them. And, of course, be very transparent with the donors and the people who are going to support you. So. Yeah, sure.
Are there any comparable programs that are doing anything to assuage the effects of poverty on young boys?
What we feel is we targeted girls because if you look at the statistics, it's girls who are most often left behind when a decision is made by a family to send their children to school. And what we find is when we invest in girls' education, it's obviously having an effect at the same time on boys. So if you're building a school that's very child-friendly, that's girl-friendly, it's going to be good for the boys as well. So I think there's a ricochet effect when we do that. But it's a good question, and it comes out, and it's important. Is there anything else? I know you have a lot of things to go on to afterwards and workshops and so on.
I'm gonna ask a question too. Yeah. So, this isn't planned yet. I came up with it right. So your story. Get you a prize later. You have a very inspirational and aspirational story that I think a lot of people might try to live up to after a while. What could they, as current students, do to get that like first start to one day do the type of social impact work that you're doing?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, you know, again, like myself, you know, I see an issue that really made me upset, really made me want to do something, but I had no clue how to do it. So the first thing is really research what you're trying to change. The more information you have, then you'll have more ideas of what it is that you can do, how you can use your particular talents to move things forward. And just keep talking to people. I mean, networking, going to conferences. I'm constantly learning. We're working actually here with McGill, the Faculty of Education. I'm on the board at ICID, the Institute for Studies in International Development. You know, we're constantly meeting people and trying to do more. Any individual can have an impact today. You know, often people come up and say, well, I don't have money and I can't make a donation and so on. But you're all consumers. You can all make decisions on what you buy or don't buy, what you do at home, how you act. You can certainly lend your talents. For 60 million girls, we're actually actively looking for young people in particular because you're very, very good with technology. And we know that technology can take these projects far. So we're constantly on the lookout for people who can help us just identify potential projects, apps, even video games. Gaming is becoming more and more important in education. So there's certainly talents that you have that can be used in any organization. I look at ours and it's kind of like a small business. You know, we have an accounting section, we have a volunteer, so a human resource section, we have a research and development, we have a communications team, we have a team that looks after evaluating the projects. So no matter what your talents are, you can certainly use them. You just, again, you have to investigate and get the information that you need. Yes?
You're full-time in this?
No, I'm not. I have a business. So I have a manufacturing business that I run, so I do this on the side. I actually made a decision, as I said, I've had my business since 1991, and I made a decision around 2005 because this was very, very important to me. And I thought, well, I can do two things in life. I can work really, really hard and try to donate a lot of money to push forward what I believe in. But I thought, you know, I'm going to have a hard time to be able to donate, you know, $250,000 every year. And then the other thing I could do is to use my talents and try to leverage that to have a greater impact. And so I actually restructured my business. I now do subcontract almost all the manufacturing, so I don't have employees anymore. So that's still my source of income, so I'm able to live, but it gives me a lot more flexibility to work on the projects. So people sometimes ask me how many hours a week I spend on the foundation. It varies a lot. It's probably at least 25 to 30 hours a week, but it's on my mind all the time, all the time. And it's a fascinating thing I find to be doing. Yes? And volunteer? Not necessarily through us, possibly through some of our partners who are in the field. Some partners have very specific programs. It might not necessarily be teaching, but it could be other things that they help out with. Again, we always deal with partners there, so it's not our projects, but we rather fund them. So. But there are things that exist for sure. Yes? First of all, I have to say we have the best team in the world, right? We have these amazing people. It started out when I was doing the event for UNICEF. You start talking to your family, and then you start talking to your neighbors, and start talking to my daughter's parents, so other adults. And so we had developed a team there. And then with time, it's sort of spread word to mouth. You know, you bring your friend in or your sister or whatever. We're about 40 members in the foundation today. So we've grown quite a bit. Yes?
How would you describe your leadership style? Because you say, I think you said that it's your foundation, but how much of it is actually you and how much of it is collaborative?
Well, I would say it's really all collaborative. There's no way I could do this on my own. I made the first move to actually establish the foundation, but from the beginning we were a team, and the team has kept growing. So really, it's not something I could do on my own for sure. The other thing that's helped us tremendously, we wouldn't have been able to do this probably 15 years ago because we're a virtual organization. We don't have offices, so everybody works from home. We send things by email, and we use the internet all the time. So we get together maybe every 6 weeks, but we talk to each other on the phone and so on. So, but it has to be a team, definitely. Yeah. Yes?
You said something about raising money for one of the most important things. From your experience in UNICEF and your organization, what are the best forms of fundraising used as a sort of words to something like this?
When I did the project at UNICEF, the typical thing is to do a big gala or a big event. So we had this big dinner, and we were selling tickets, I think, at $250 each. And, we targeted, I think, to have 250 people there, and we had a silent auction and so on. And we managed to reach our goal, so we raised just over $100,000. But it was so much work. And as we were trying to sell tickets, I kept getting, that's not a good day, or that's not the type of event I like to go to, or, I don't go out too much. So I actually was able to raise as much money just from donations as from selling tickets. So when we decided to start the foundation, and because we were so small, and of course we didn't have a UNICEF name of recognition for everybody, we said, let's forget the event, so we don't have an event. And it's been word of mouth. So we just talk to people about what we do, and then people make donations. The only one thing that we do in the fall, we have a small conference, and that's basically sort of the only means for us to get together with our donors face-to-face and update them on what we're doing. So we have a little cocktail and a little silent auction, and we bring in a speaker. We've had Stephen Lewis come in to speak, and Craig Hilberger, and so on. So we raise about $15,000 or $20,000 at that event, so it's a very, very small part of what we do. So it's hard, because the other thing I find, too, is when you have a really big event, it's almost like you have to keep topping yourself every year, and it gets harder and harder, and we find, too, that people are so busy, they're doing so many other things, and you can go to all kinds of events, when you're in a big city like Montreal, and our donors tend to really appreciate the educative part of the conference. It starts at 6 o'clock. By 8:30, we're finished. People are in and out. And that seems to work for us. So,
stop. I have to end the questions. Maybe?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Are you going to stick around?
Yes, I'll be here if anybody has
Excellent.
Any questions.
So Wanda will be available after as well, in case you have any last pressing questions. Please join me in thanking once again Wanda for that great keynote.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It's kind of what I said before. I think that's a mix of inspiration, aspiration for a lot of you. I think Wanda's words were excellent when she said, just find what you're passionate about now, find what you care about, do your research, find the groups that are working with that, find the people that are working with that, and go from there. And hopefully some of the workshops today and the people that you meet can help you get started on that.
So some logistics just to go over. Right now we're going to move into the networking and food part of the night. So we have pizza and other refreshments for you, and then some chance for you to talk with the other people who are here today. There are going to be three different workshops going on after that at about 7:20. They're listed in your manual. There's All in Good Time, which is about time and life management, positive mindset, about discovering the science of happiness, and Hear from Peers, which is a popular panel we have of current student execs that's moderated by one of our facilitators. The way it's going to work is that after that, there's another workshop called Next Steps. After that, you're going to have the opportunity to sign out, if you will, from this conference. Those of you who registered and then sign out at the end, once we know you've attended for the entire evening, your names and information will be added to My Involvement, McGill's co-curricular record that tracks extracurricular involvement that you've done here at McGill. And also those who stay for the entire portion of the evening will be entered into a draw for fun prizes. So, of course, not that you needed any extrinsic motivation to continue on with the evening, but there it is for you. Okay, that got my biggest laughter of the night, which is pretty sad because usually I am. That got a little bit more. Okay, always a little though. Okay, thank you. We will be exiting through that door. The facilitators will help you. They'll also bring you the next workshops. A note on that, actually, I don't want to get in competition with Wanda about who has the best volunteer team, but we do have a really great volunteer team. So be nice to them. Thank them. They've done a great job. And you can fill out the evaluation at the end of the event as well. So if you exit over there.